Chapter 2. Money was short. Although Mom sold the house, I had little left after paying off St. B and the doctors and all the tradesmen who'd kindly extended us credit. So we moved to New York and rented an airless, dark, two-bedroom, third-floor apartment at 626 West 165th Street. Mom refused to ask the relatives for help, fearing they'd find out about Uncle Sam and the theft. She preferred want to scandal. But she paid a price. Shamed by her poverty and her imperfect English, she rarely budged from her bedroom. Every day she perched on an old cedar chest that smelled like a forest when opened and stared out the window at the grass tennis courts across the street on the grounds of Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. She watched the doctors and nurses play tennis in their snooty white shirts, shorts, and shoes. What fancies raced through Mom's brain, I have no idea. But I know what I thought. Loneliness can swallow up the world, and poverty just makes it worse. Bernard Shore, whom Pop idolized, was dead right. It's a crime to be poor, a crime against health and well-being. So I swore that unlike the people slaving in factories, the America of needle and thread, backaches, and 10 cents an hour, I would rather be a thief than a pauper. Shortly after we moved to New York, I started my apprenticeship with Charles Courtney. Needing a dress, I asked Mom to help, and not by offering one of her own. She bought a length of tubular cotton jersey, stitched one end, leaving just enough room for my head, and cut holes for my arms. Turning the raw edges to the inside, she finished them with small slip stitches. The mannish, flat-chested look, much in style, suited my figure to a T, and you couldn't beat the price, $1.75 for the material. Each morning, I walked to work, 40 blocks, to save a nickel. Mr. Courtney told me I was the first girl he'd ever employed, and maybe the only girl in all of New York training to be a locksmith. His shop enabled me to meet famous people, like Bill Tilden and David Belasco and Harry Houdini. One of the reasons so many celebrities patronized Mr. Courtney was that they loved the inside of his place. In the late afternoon light, the rows of lathes and key machines and the board hung with thousands of blank keys, made jagged patterns on the walls and the floor. The shop itself had several divides. Just inside the front door was a small fenced-off space reserved for customers. A swinging gate led to the work area, which held 8 benches. Each had its own machines and tools. Vices, pliers, chisels, nutcrackers, a giant pair of shoemaker's nippers, tension wrenches, picks, shims, shove knives, files, made in Switzerland, and of course, jeweler's tweezers, screwdrivers, and loops. The thousands of key blanks were grouped alphabetically by company and organized by millings. For some companies, like Yale, our stock ran to over 100 different kinds of blanks. The shop cut them to order on key machines from Barrows, Corbin, Eagle, Keel, Lockwood, Master, Norwalk, Penn, Reading Knob, Ruswin, Sager, Sargent, Schlage, and Yale. Although most of the machines were interchangeable, Mr. C insisted that by owning them all, he was prepared for every eventuality, like cutting intricate tubular keys or designing masters for office buildings. Off to one side was a small trophy room displaying some of the locks and keys that Mr. C had collected on his various trips round the world. An elegant heart-shaped lock from the coffer of Cardinal Infanti. A famous padlock that Ivan the Terrible used to imprison the woman he loved, causing her death and the death of his infant son. The key to Lincoln Prison in Ireland, where De Valera and many other Irish rebels were incarcerated. a stout lock made by Martin Luther's father, and an exquisite iron lock from the brother of Philip IV of Spain, with two mythical animals locking horns. These priceless items were kept in two safes at the rear of the shop in Mr. C's private office. One safe had come from the Vanderbilts, and the other from Abraham Lincoln's Illinois law offices. In the first, he kept my favorite lock, made of brass and fashioned in India. It was probably older than Timur the Tartar. A Hindu bird with a cock's comb and a leaf in his mouth hid the keyhole under a movable wing. Mr. C sat in a swivel chair in front of a roll-top desk covered with papers and pieces of locks. He could never keep his love of the shop separate from his paperwork. When he tired of bills and invoices, he would push them aside and turn his favorite pick on a particularly intractable lock. On the wall over his desk hung a dagger-like sharp knife with saw teeth on one edge. During World War I, Mr. C had served in the Marines as a diver. He never slipped into the sea without that knife at his side. And although he wouldn't talk about close calls with sharks, "People are worse," he said. "There looked to be dried blood on the teeth." The knife was surrounded by dozens of framed photographs of foreign princes and kings and presidents, including one of the old Tsar of Russia. But my favorites were the ones hanging on the other three walls, photographs of moving picture actors and actresses like John Barrymore, Charlie Chaplin, Theda Bara, Clara Bow, and Mary Pickford, and Broadway directors like Belasco and Ziegfeld, and especially of vaudeville stars like Nora Bayes, Eddie Cantor, W.C. Fields, and Joe Frisco, who stuttered and signed with an X because he couldn't read or write, Georgie Jessel, Al Jolson, Harry Richman. On slow days, I would duck into Mr. C's office and peer at the pictures. But in the beginning of my apprenticeship, free time was rare. Mr. C insisted that before being assigned my own bench, I had to learn about the history of shackles. So he sat me down in his office and began with the ancient Egyptians. I learned more about history in those 2 days than I did in 2 years of high school. Once we'd covered the past, we turned to wadded locks, which have wards or guards that protect against arbitrary keys. For a key to enter the keyhole, slip past the wards, and encounter the dead bolt, it must be notched or bitted correctly. Then turning the key to the right or the left will advance or retract the dead bolt, locking or unlocking the door. I soon became schooled in the second oldest profession. But the juiciest part of my lessons concerned picking a pentumbler lock. An outer cylinder encases a rotating inner cylinder or plug. In a locked position, metal pins extend partially within the cylinder and partially within the plug, preventing the plug from turning. To turn it, you need to separate the tumblers. It takes two tools, a tension wrench and a pick. The tension wrench is used like a shim. You put it in the top or bottom of the keyhole and apply tension in the direction that the lock is designed to release. The tension produces a half turn and prevents the tumblers from falling out and freezing the lock. With the pick, you position the tumblers so that the uppers remain in the cylinder while the lowers remain in the plug. The line between them, the shear line, is then clear, forming a gate that allows the plug to be turned and thus opened. Mr. C advised me to start at the back of the lock with the last tumblers. Pushing them up, you move forward, picking each one in turn. But Mr. C's favorite means of entry was to impression a key. Some locksmiths recommend carbon coating the blank, holding the key blank over a flame to coat it with carbon. Carefully inserting and turning it, you remove the key to see where the carbon has been erased. Those spots you file. Mr. C despised gumming up the lock with carbon. Instead, he directed me to do the following. First, take a Swiss file and prepare the key by lightly filing off the hard outer key plating. Second, place the head of the key in a vice grip plier and insert the key in the lock. Third, apply pressure to the right or the left and then jiggle up and down. This movement will leave a faint mark. Fourth, using a delicate file, remove no more than a little metal at each mark, repeating the procedure until the right depth is reached. Mr. C contended that a first-rate locksmith proceeding this way could cut a key in under 5 minutes. During those first few weeks, while learning all about locks, keys, and safes, I accompanied Mr. C on a number of jobs. The one I liked best was like a Sherlock Holmes mystery and led to my meeting Lily Gillespie. A house in Southport had been robbed. The safe, which contained jewels and rare silver, had been opened without being forced. Well, since the only two people who knew the combination were the owner, Mr. Deutscher, a banker, and his secretary, Mr. Linz, they locked up the latter. As we drove along the sea on a magnificent morning, the water shone luminously purple and blue. Overhead, gulls glided and dove, at one moment displaying their silvery bellies and the next their ebony sides. The contrast of the black inkberries against the white sand for some reason made me think of a tuxedo. The house, a massive dark stucco fortress with narrow barred windows, sat overlooking the bay. A butler opened the thick oak door and led us to Mr. Deutscher's study upstairs at the end of a hall. A short, gaunt, bloodless man, Mr. Deutscher greeted us formally with something resembling a bow. He looked like a mortician, dressed in a black suit with a white shirt and navy blue tie. His balding blonde hair was spider-leg thin, matching the delicate wire arms of his glasses. Instead of launching into the robbery, as I had expected, he began with comments such as, "I trust that what passes between us will remain confidential," and "Silence never betrays." After some preachments about discreetness being a mark of refinement and manners the measure of a man, he concluded with the observation that he enjoyed considerable influence in New York society, especially amongst businessmen, honest businessmen who are the backbone of America. But even so, he did not wish to involve his associates in this robbery or his personal friends. "Let discretion be your tutor," he said. "You never can tell who's really to blame." Although his secretary had been hauled off to the local jail, Mr. Deutscher didn't believe in the poor fellow's guilt. The arrest, he explained, had been the idea of the local police, who had deduced that since the only person beside the banker who knew the safe's combination was the secretary, he had to be guilty. "This young man's been in my employ for 5 years, said Mr. Deutscher. "He's from good Protestant stock, German. I've shared with him the most sensitive details of the bank and of my personal holdings, and he has always conducted himself as a gentleman. Besides, he's no fool, quite the opposite. So why would he steal from me when such a theft would so readily point to him?" A closet, one of two in the study, held a large safe that looked very secure. Mr. C mumbled something about floors and directed me to help him tip the safe forward. With the safe leaning on its front edge, he spun the dials at random. Clang! The safe door swung open. Mr. Deutscher looked shell-shocked. "That's all it took?" he asked. "No more than that." "Your safe came from Austria," replied Mr. C. "The first 10 safes of this type were defectively cast, so the door doesn't open and close as it should. Tipping the safe forward forces the locking bolt back. All it takes is a twist of the dials, as you've just seen me do. The manufacturer tried to recall the 10 safes, but 3 of them couldn't be traced. Mr. C looked around as if he'd lost something. Tell me, do you have any Austrians working for you? The parchment that passed for Mr. Deutsch's face suddenly acquired some color.
I did. A gardener. He came to work for me when I returned from Vienna, but he quit 2 days ago.
I'm willing to bet, said Mr. C, that if the police track him down, they'll discover he once worked at the Austrian factory that made these safes.
Pretty slick, I said.
What invites that conclusion? Asked a surprised Mr. Deutscher, turning his peepers on me.
I blurted, he tracked you down and talked you into a job, didn't he? Lucky for you, Mr. Courtney knew about the floored safes, otherwise the guy would have gone undetected. With an edge to his voice, Mr. Deutscher observed,
anyone who believes that it is pretty slick to live by robbery rather than by gainful employment does not belong in this country.
I shot back. A great many famous Americans walking the streets today are nothing more than robber barons.
Do your parents approve of their daughter working as an apprentice locksmith? Mr. Deutscher asked, clearly annoyed. Shouldn't you be in school or learning a feminine trade?
She's first rate, Mr. C said. Top of the line, as good as any of the young men in my shop.
If you were my daughter and lacked any aptitude for college, how old are you?
16.
I would keep you at home learning refinement and duty.
Growing expansive, Mr. Deutscher added,
without women to show us the way, what is the point of our faith, hard work, and self-sufficiency?
Mr. C remarked that he'd spent several childhood years in Germany, where he had learned all he ever wanted to know about discipline. While he and Mr. Deutscher talked about Teutonic culture and discussed what kind of safe would best serve the banker, I went outside to get a gander at the place next door, which I'd seen from an upstairs window. Mr. Deutsch's joint resembled a convent, but his neighbor's, a radiant red brick colonial home trimmed all in white, screamed tasteful gelt. The two houses, separated by a low natural stone wall, represented two different cultures. On Mr. Deutsch's side, formal gardens had been laid out in fastidious circles and squares. The neighbor's grounds had a pond and a small riding track, large enough to accommodate the Shetland pony that a nurse led by the reins as a young child perched in the saddle. Below the track, a stretch of lawn ran to the bay. There, rocking slowly in the tide, stood a red sailboat moored to a small wooden dock, with a pole that held a green windsock, languidly flapping in the breeze. I could see on the veranda, under an arbor of yellow roses, a shining young woman wave to the child. Her arms and neck displayed dazzling jewelry, and the barrette in her dark, lustrous hair reflected the sun. Even her white linen dress glowed like gold. I smiled and waved. She crossed the lawn to me.